Welcome to the Displacement Urbanism podcast series, hosted through the London School of Economics. My name is Dr. Romola Sanyal, and I am Associate Professor in Urban Geography at the Department of Geography and Environment here at the LSE. In this podcast series, we explore how cities and displacement co-constitute each other. As we see millions of displaced people moving to cities and millions of people displaced in cities around the world, the questions of how these processes intersect are crucial. In this podcast, I will be interviewing a range of actors, including those who have been displaced in different ways and those who are involved in the management and the study of displacement. We will be going around the world to explore the different issues around this topic. I hope the podcast offers an opportunity to open up conversations around the politics and processes of displacement and urbanization, the different ways it can be experienced, understood, and approached. I also hope that the podcast demonstrates how these are global and interconnected issues, but also one that draws our attention to its local specificities. Welcome, everybody, to this episode of Displacement Urbanism. Our episode today is titled Ongoing Displacements in Haiti and the Making of Canaan. I am delighted to introduce our speaker for today, Christopher Ward, who is a political scientist focusing on informality, informal settlements, and the political economy of aid, with a particular focus on urban contexts within crisis-affected states. He has, over the past 17 years, worked across relief, recovery, and reconstruction efforts in multiple post-disaster and post-crisis contexts. These include Sudan, Haiti, Burkina Faso, Iraq, Nepal, Micronesia, Mali, Niger, and Senegal, with USAID, the EU, the World Bank, and the UN. He is currently completing a PhD at the Institute of Development Studies at the University of Sussex. Welcome to the podcast, Chris.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So I'm particularly intrigued by the work that you've done in the context of Haiti, so I was hoping that we could talk about that today. So I wanted to just start by asking you if you could just walk us through how the humanitarian response there led to the first internal displacement of people and the creation of this new city of Canaan.
This is a very interesting story and one that, as I think we'll get into, still has resonance with current events. In fact, even though the earthquake now happened almost, it'll be 15 years in January. I helped work on that response beginning really in the first few days of the response from Washington, D.C., and then began working on it from Port-au-Prince beginning in about 5 weeks after the quake. I then spent the subsequent 7 years living and working in Port-au-Prince as the international community worked with the Haitian government and communities to address, you know, the immediate relief and recovery needs, then into the longer term reconstruction and development. For those of your listeners who don't know about that disaster or don't remember the details, given that quite a bit of time has passed, this was at the time one of the largest urban humanitarian crises ever. We don't have very good figures of the number of people killed in the quake. That was a highly politicized figure at the time. The estimates range from about 40 to 50,000 on some independent studies, all the way to the government of Haiti's official estimate of 300,000 plus killed. The UN has a figure around 200,000 that they cited in the months and years after 2010. Regardless of what that number was, though, it was a massive disaster. It was a powerful earthquake, but not necessarily in other parts of the world would have been a catastrophic one like it was. But due to decades of endemic poverty and political crisis, long before the earthquake and unfortunately extending since, Port-au-Prince and the surrounding cities that were most affected by the quake were really devastated. You know, we had tens of thousands of buildings completely destroyed, as well as all to the loss of life across the city. Many of the informal settlements, which at the time were estimated to be about 70 to 80% of the population were living in urban settlements at the time of the earthquake, were devastated, but so were higher, you know, upper class, middle class neighborhoods as well. Across all levels of Haitian society and sort of social life, we saw devastating effects of the quake. There was also, partly in response to the devastation, partly because of the geopolitical aspects of where the disaster happened, at the geopolitical moment at which it happened, which was early in the Obama administration. And because it's a hour and a half plane ride for media from the US to come and capture some of this shocking footage, and because of the large, large percentage of the Haitian population that is either immigrated formally or irregularly into the US, there was a lot of interest in the disaster. And so there's also a massive outpouring of international support in terms of immediate aid and then commitments for billions of dollars of relief and reconstruction activities. And so you had this already very crowded, very poor, very vulnerable city, capital city, I should say, of the country. And then you had hundreds of international NGOs, dozens of international organizations, and other bilateral country missions coming in with resources, goodwill, and ideas on how to respond and help deal with this unprecedented humanitarian catastrophe. The other defining feature in the first year to 2 years of the post-quake context was the establishment, sometimes formal, but also oftentimes just informally, organically, of tent cities within central locations throughout Port-au-Prince, the main downtown square in front of the presidential palace, parks and open areas and sort of underutilized plots of land all across the city became, in the hours after the quake, a place where people slept the first nights because there was aftershocks going on. And for months, people were sleeping outdoors in these makeshift camps. You then had humanitarian actors providing aid in those camps, which we soon began to note as we're monitoring the situation that this was bringing in a lot of inflow of additional residents who may or may not have been affected directly. I mean, certainly everybody was indirectly affected in some way. Everybody knew somebody who had been killed, had some damage to their family's property or something like this. But the camps became pull factors too, or in the humanitarian response. And they went from being estimated populations in the hundreds of thousands to a high of estimated, though we need to take many of these figures we're going to talk about today in Haiti and any fragile context, really. You know, these data are oftentimes guesstimates rather than exact figures. But the official UN government of Haiti height of the displaced IDP camp populations was 1.6 million. And so a big part of the response was not just clearing the rubble, which choked most of the thoroughfares in the city for months and months after the quake, and beginning to rebuild homes. But the focus really became on getting people out of these tent camps, these IDP camps. So there's a number of unprecedented things about this and a number of things within the humanitarian community that the Haiti earthquake is famous for. I noted the large loss of life and the huge outpouring of resources into the country, the highly mediatized, highly political environment, because it was a very, very important Obama administration priority, foreign policy priority for a number of months after the quake. But also then that media and those resources brought in just every international organization and their brother, if I can put it that way. So there were so many organizations trying to help, but it was a famously chaotic, some would say sort of shambolic response, given the many cooks in the kitchen, if you will. This was one of my first major humanitarian response. It was quite eye-opening in a lot of ways to see these dynamics play out with all these kind of very complicated moving parts that I just described. The United States sent 20,000 troops through what was called the Joint Mission to stabilize the country, because there was fears that there would be breakdown in the rule of law and order. And so there was a massive U.S. military presence there in the first 6 months of the response as well. So quite exceptional in a number of ways.
Thanks for that overview as well. That's really helpful. And I've heard a lot about how shambolic that response was by the humanitarian sector in particular, a lessons learned for many organizations, especially when they're trying to do work in urban environments, because they point to what happened in Haiti and say that was really bad and we shouldn't do that again. The legacy of what happened in Haiti during and after the earthquake, not just in terms of humanitarian responses, but also about displacements, has been continuing on till today, right? So one of the things that we wanted to talk about today was also Canaan, which is one of the places that you've talked about where people have been displaced into. So could you just tell us a little bit about how it came about and how it functions, please?
Canaan was basically a windswept, slightly sloping plain of several hundred square kilometers just on the northern border of Port-au-Prince, and almost completely vacant. It had been a sisal plantation, which was a major export for Haiti up until the 70s, but then fell out of favor with the international market and closed. There was a few rock quarries in the area, but the 2003 census, which is the last official census conducted in the country, had less than a few thousand people living in the entire zone. No water was there, very dry area, but strategically located because it's directly adjacent to where Port-au-Prince would, given the geographical features where it sits in a bay in a sort of a saddle-shaped low mountain range, would need to extend if it ever was allowed to. This land had actually been under the control, depending on who you talk to, legally owned, or at least through political influence, controlled by a consortium of some of the biggest economic elite families in the country, who had pooled their resources to have a contiguous set of plots that covered this entire expanse. And they were hoping to receive significant international investment for a new free trade zone in the area. And so they had very diligently over the years made sure there was no settlement on the area. I talked about the diplomatic and humanitarian crisis of those 1.6 million people in IDP camps in urban Port-au-Prince. The international community, beginning in the spring after the January earthquake, a few months later, began really pressing the president at the time, President Breval, to provide somewhere for, quote unquote, these people to go, to relocate these people, to get them safe, but also to clear important public areas within the city, which was becoming a bigger and bigger issue with upper class and middle class folks. The government was pushed to begin an eminent domain process for this entire swath of land, very valuable land, you know, in terms of where its location was, and to authorize the construction of on a relatively small parcel within the center of that, a relocation camp for some of the, what we're seeing, most vulnerable camp residents within Port-au-Prince proper. It's also important to remember that Port-au-Prince, I mean, it's a beautiful city in some ways seen from on high, but when you get closer and you see the sort of the poverty up close, but it sits on a very picturesque natural bay with mountains rising right up from the sea. And so many of the neighborhoods, both low income and upper income, on very steep slopes. And so where people had congregated in these internal displacement camps, these camps were seen as at risk, rightfully so, of flooding and landslides. And so there was a need to get some of the more vulnerable people relocated to safer areas. And this area of Canaan was designated by the government, albeit with some reluctance. There was a public utility decree issued to begin an eminent domain process to make a portion of this available for relocation of some of these IDPs. This public utility decree allowed for the U.S. military, who, as I noted, was president at the time, several UN organizations and several international NGOs, to set up a camp for about 5,000 people, which was called Kurai, within this larger zone that is known as Canaan. And as I'm sure some of your listeners who know about these kind of dynamics will not find surprising, which happened quite to the surprise of the international organizations involved, this led to what I think was an entirely predictable land invasion that started off in this zone. You had high value land. You had a city that had already been formed by dozens, if not hundreds, of land invasions over the previous 20 years to form informal settlements. You had a government that for two decades had been really unable to manage land allocation through formal rule of law processes. And instead, the land market was highly irregular and informal. And you had now, post-quake, a government that was completely stretched thin and on its knees. At first, I remember visiting at the point where the first relocated IDPs were brought to this now, you know, nicely constructed tent camp. We started to see on the hillsides around it little structures, even just sort of like flags being planted in the ground, popping up in the dozens or hundreds on the hillsides around there. I didn't quite realize it at the time, but now with the benefit of hindsight and also experiences of similar situations in other places, I now know that was the first signs of what would become, just 4 or 5 years later, a whole new city or a set of contiguous cities, which are called by the entire region Canaan, but that have different subsections and sub-blocks within them, totaling, at best guess, by 2016, 300,000 people. So this is a large city, I think, by any standard, that emerges from nothing. It's also particularly large in a country which officially only has 12.9 million residents as of the 2019 census. So maybe there's going to be a million or two more, but still, it's a significantly sized city in Haiti. Also quite significant because the development of the city happened with almost no international public or government of Haiti public investment or even oversight or even visiting of the zone. Because of the murky land tenure situation that defined how the invasion happened, and because of its irregular nature, it was seen as, by various actors, by the international community, a sort of illegal and an anarchic, chaotic mess that, you know, we just didn't want to get into. It was seen by many government of Haiti officials as something that they would get around to cleaning up once they were back on their feet and things were going a bit more normally. And it was seen by the landlords or the land claimants, who are this consortium of wealthy families, as a direct assault on a very important asset that they had. So they were trying to pull out all the stops at the time to apply pressure international diplomatically on the Haitian government, their connections within the Haitian justice system, to get the authorities to do something about it. But the speed and the scale at which this happened basically made all of this moot. Also, once a critical mass was hit, and then we know this from interviews done at the time from some organizations that were looking at the zone, and also subsequent interviews that I've done now, trying to recreate the history of this with community leaders who helped kind of found the zone. Once they felt that they had a critical mass of, you know, a few thousand, maybe 10,000 people, it became clear to everybody that they were going to be able to probably stay for quite some time. And so I remember first visiting the zone maybe 6 months after this all began and starting to see cinder block cement construction popping up, some even two-story buildings, early days of the post-quake response. So in Haiti, there's virtually no publicly available or publicly funded education. It's all private investment. We started to see private school buildings made of cinder blocks going up. And that's a significant investment for the type of people who run these sort of schools. And so people were voting with their wallets and voting with their feet and coming to this new area of land opened up within the greater metropolitan area to basically start a new life. This occupation was also seen as a very, by both sides, politicized and political action that was made possible because of this crisis moment, but that some were very happy with, others not, but was a political hot potato for a number of years for international actors trying to involve themselves in the reconstruction. And so basically what happened was that you had donors and international NGOs running all over Port-au-Prince, trying to figure out a way to rebuild homes, repair structures, get people with cash rental subsidies out of these camps, but facing a lot of hurdles because it was a very complex and challenging context for political, economic, social, and technical engineering and geophysical reasons. At the same time, Haitians themselves in Canaan were rebuilding tens of thousands of units of housing stock. It almost became sort of a Rorschach blot test for me of like where one stood on how you thought development in general should happen. What is development? Who should lead on development? What you see is the role of the state versus community versus international NGOs. By 1 or 2 years after the quake, it was a fait accompli. And there was a massive outpouring of agency and resources from these supposedly completely destitute Haitian urban masses, who in fact seemed to have quite a bit of, you know, if given the opportunity, in the form of land to rebuild their city. This was not being taken advantage of or guided in any way. And the problem there was, if you don't start to provide some sort of structure to these places at some point, the cost of retroactively retrofitting to provide services, to maintain rights of way, becomes exponentially more expensive. And the citizens realized that they were leaving space for wide roads. They were leaving spaces for police stations, which they only had the idea of being built in the future, some of which, through projects that I was involved in many years later, were eventually built. They were leaving spaces for public parks and schools and churches and football pitches. And so there was this early new settler mentality of, you know, we're going to remake this place in the shadows of the old Port-au-Prince, but how we wish that our old lives would be. And the other important thing in terms of how people perceived it is, many international NGOs, I think, and international actors were not able to understand that these people were not all earthquake displaced or affected directly. This was a land settlement movement. Many were earthquake affected, but many were not. And they definitely were not the poorest of the poor in many cases, because they had at least some resources to purchase parcels of land, because only the original, very initial settlers there got it for free, if you will. And they often had political links. The UN and the Haitian government defined this as an IDP camp of earthquake displaced people, not either wanting to or not able to recognize the fact that this was something distinct from people setting up a tent in a park. This was an informal market-based land invasion where a new construction boom was happening, whether or not the government and the elite wanted it to.
That's a super interesting story. And I love that you were able to see what was happening and be able to share some of these details with us. I particularly love the fact that, you know, you were talking about how people left space for roads and football pitches and police stations. And it really kind of shows visioning and thinking about the future and planning from the bottom up. It's a real shame that it was not taken advantage of by the organizations and not supported in that way. The outcome of that was rather unfortunate, right? Because we have Canaan as it evolved, right? So there's been this issue now of it being taken over by gangs. And I was wondering if you could also tell us a little bit about how that's come about and what some of the repercussions have been as well.
I worked on some projects along with groups, including the Prime Minister's Office, the American Red Cross, Habitat for Humanity, UN Habitat, and USAID. 3 or 4 years after the formation of Canaan, we're able to convince enough people in positions of influence in these different organizations to invest some money in helping reinforce what the community had already begun. And so that included the first paved road, albeit only about 2 kilometers worth of road in the main downtown of the new city, livelihood support and support for the market that the community had also left space for, and making some of those public parks and sort of green areas better equipped so that they wouldn't continue to feel the pressure of encroachment from private construction and kind of solidify them. Unfortunately, beginning in 2018 and then accelerating in 2019 all the way until today, the country has been engulfed in one of its most significant political and insecurity crises in the last 50 years, which is to say a lot, given that, you know, there was a U.S. Marine invasion in 1994. There was a UN peacekeeping mission there between 2004 and 2017. There was several coups and a military junta in the 90s. It's been a country that has just been battered by one crisis after another. But the current one is reaching new depths of violence and state dissolution and the fall of governance and depravity, actually, even in terms of the violence that's being committed against particularly the population of Port-au-Prince. It's a crisis that's affecting the entire country, but it's centered on Port-au-Prince, where gangs within the city, who have been a feature of Haitian sort of urban and political life for several decades now, have filled the vacuum in the political and governance space left by this political crisis that began in 2018 between the president at the time and the opposition, who are oftentimes implicated, I think probably rightfully so, though I don't study this particularly directly, but we're using gangs as proxies for their political competition. And this has recently slipped the bonds of that control by the political elite and become an all-out gang warfare context. And it's become one of the most violent and insecure cities in the world now since 2019. Tops many of these lists. Just this year, it's estimated that 5,000 citizens have been killed in the country just from this urban violence and basically gang battles. And more importantly, the police and the Haitian government have lost control of an estimated 80% or more of the capital city, including at times the international airport and the only international fuel terminal in the country. Basically, the state has ceased to exist in many ways throughout urban Port-au-Prince. This originally was centered on downtown near the port, some of the oldest parts of the city and which were the most impoverished and violent for decades. But beginning in 2021, 2022, it began to extend into ever greater portions of the metropolitan area, and Canaan become affected as well. And so people I had known and worked with were sharing with me the stories of the police's increasingly insufficient battles against these gangs as they tried to extend their control over territory. And Canaan, I think it's also important to note, rests at the crossroads of two of the country's nine national highways. So it sits at this crossroads between National Highway 1 and National Highway 9, and they meet right where Canaan starts. And so controlling those routes is a very valuable area for the gangs. Began to target that in 2021, 2022. And by January 2023, they were able to beat back all of the police presence in these zones, take over the entire area, kill or cause to flee sort of all of the community leaders, the original founders of the zones, anyone with any ties to the state, or of even sort of prominent figures who might be able to mobilize the community to resist the gang. So even religious leaders, small-scale NGO leaders, things like this. So thousands have fled. Those who are too poor, don't have anywhere else to go, have remained. But Canaan, unfortunately, since early 2023, is completely under what the Haitian press often calls the reign of the gangs. So the police have never gone back there for now a year and a half. I actually just found out this week that in the last week of November, the gang which controls Canaan, which is known as the Taliban, and it's run by a gangster that goes by the nickname or nom de guerre of Little Jeff or T. Jeff in Creole. So kidnapping for ransom and tolls have been the main ways that they finance their activities. And sitting on those two national highways has been lucrative for them. They also have set up a prison in the last few weeks and have developed a system of sort of summary justice for their rule of the zone. So it's a very uncertain future for Canaan. What had once been a complicated but hopeful story of people trying to rebuild and reconstruct and kind of re-envision a new future in the ruins of the post-quake context has been overtaken by these larger sort of national political dynamics. And I think also somewhat surprising and depressing for me, compared to the level of outpouring of international support and engagement after the earthquake, it's really been crickets in terms of the international community responding to this crisis in Haiti. It's been surprising for me to see, despite the fact that this crisis for me feels so much more existential and extreme for people trapped in it than the earthquake, actually. Because the earthquake, the rebuilding process, it was a big tragedy, but there was a sense of hope. This crisis has not engendered the same sort of mobilization of international interest or resources.
It's really quite sad that things have moved in this direction, as you say, that the international attention to what's been happening in Haiti has also been largely missing. So I was wondering that, you know, given the work that you have done in Haiti and also that you've worked in other parts of the world, you've chosen to focus on Haiti for so much of your work, including your research work. I was wondering if you could just, in closing, tell us a little bit about how you feel that your experience and your research in Haiti feeds into how you think about your work.
So a question I've been grappling with through the PhD is how best can international aid be brought to bear in crisis-affected and fragile contexts? And I think the Haiti experience, you know, for me, there was a lot of hard lessons learned there. I probably came in much more naive and optimistic about what we collectively were going to be able to do than when I left the country. For me, it provided a good dose of humility in what we should be in our aspirations as external actors coming into incredibly complex situations with long histories that will be very hard for someone coming in for a 3 month, 9 month, even 2 year mission to ever fully grasp. And that we need to be quite careful how resources and political influence that we do come armed with as external actors do the best we can, but also paying very close attention to doing no harm, which has become sort of a mantra, obviously, in the humanitarian community. But I think it still needs to be really internalized through a humble positioning versus what we can claim we're going to be able to do, what we will actually achieve. Because for me, even the 7 years I spent there are just a brief snapshot in the drama that is Haiti's history. And so, you know, I really hope things get better. But I also realize so many of the, better now than I did when I first would have arrived, so many of the obstacles, community level, national level, geopolitical level, that stand in the way of that situation changing significantly for the better. So that's a little bit of a maybe a downer note to end on. But I think it's important for people who are trying to engage in these really, really fragile, really, really complex situations. For me, the kind of in the writing of the PhD is, how can we bring optimistic humility to these contexts and make sure that we do a little bit of good and head off being a bigger source of problems than solutions?
Well, I think that's a really good note to end on. This has been a really interesting episode. I think it's important to look at what's been happening in Haiti, not just in terms of what happened during the earthquake, but as you pointed out, you have this crisis that has been unfolding and really a lot more attention needs to be given to it. And I'm really glad that we were able to have you on the podcast to talk to us about what has been going on there for quite some time now, and in some detail. You know, I certainly learned a lot, and this has been hugely, hugely informative. So thank you so much, Chris, for being with us today.
No, thank you for having me. It was a great pleasure.